Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today's guest is Norwegian grandmaster Simen Agdestein. You will remember that 2 weeks ago, I interviewed Atle Groen about his latest book, Games and Goals, The Fascinating Chess and Football Careers of Simen Agdestein, which had just been published by New in Chess. I very much enjoyed the talk, and while listening back to our conversation, I thought, why not ask the subject of this book, Simen Agdestein, as well? A brilliant plan, and I am pleased to say that Simen readily accepted the invitation when I called him. So here he is. But before I welcome him, let me try to sum up Simen's career in a few sentences. The first time Simen won the Norwegian championship, the chess championship, was way back in 1982. And guess what? 42 years on, he is also the current champion, as he won again in 2023 to claim his ninth title. Simen is also famous for his remarkable double career, as he also was a brilliant football player and played for the Norwegian national football team 8 times. And of course, we know Simen as the man who was the first trainer of Magnus Carlsen and believed in his tremendous potential right from the start. Simen, good day. Thank you for joining us. Where are you and how are you?
I'm very fine, thanks. I'm getting a lot of credit these days, which is nice. I'm getting a book written about me and so on. And you're interviewing me, so thanks for that.
All right.
At the moment, I'm at my office. You can see it in the background here. I have a chess office at a wonderful place, a sports school. It's a college. It's for students between 16 and 19 years old. And here I've been for the last 30 years, approximately.
That's the Norwegian Training College kids. Of Elite Sports.
Exactly. The NTG. English.
Yeah.
Correct.
So that's a school where talented sports boys and girls, they can study other subjects as while pursuing their sports careers.
Yes. It's, you get your ordinary upper secondary education and you can start studying anything at universities afterwards. But in addition, you get the sport.
Yeah.
So I kind of run the chess department, which we got included here 30 years ago almost.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to the book now, Simen. Well, you're the protagonist of Games and Goals, the book that we discussed here 2 weeks ago with the author, Atle Groen. Atle said that before he started working on the book some 4 years ago, you had made a first attempt to write an autobiography. What was your plan at the time?
My original plan was kind of, I felt I kind of had a story that I kind of should bring on to my kids, basically. I didn't really have an idea that it should be necessarily published. But it was also kind of a mental preparation for myself, what do you call it? It was good for my mentality because I had some old injuries, mental injuries, kind of. Mm-hmm. So I just had to write it down and kind of forget it. That was kind of the goal.
You mean injuries from the past?
Yes, I got injured. I had a lot of troubles in those days. So I just kind of, it was good for me to just write it down. It was like going to a psychologist almost.
Uh-huh. And by writing everything down, that might have a healing effect, you mean?
Something like that. I mean, it felt like that, actually.
Yeah.
It felt very healing. Simply to write it down, and now I'm quite tired of my own story, so I don't need to think about it. I don't need to tell anyone about it either. But since you're kind of asking, it's no need for me to say anything
because it has been written down.
Yeah, and I'm kind of over with it.
Yeah, because I was also thinking that at the NTG, the school where you're teaching, one of the subjects that you're teaching is history. And I know you very much like history, and I thought maybe you see it as some sort of a duty towards history that your story should be recorded.
I don't kind of feel it like that, I must say.
No.
But And my impression is that most people don't really care so much about neither my history or other people's history, actually. But so it was more a personal thing to simply to write it down.
Yeah.
We do a little bit history, chess history at the school, but it's just a little bit random. Sometimes we look at Max Öve and other times we look at some other old guy.
Yeah.
But it's not like they have to learn the, my history or any other history either.
Well, okay, that's maybe your personal feeling. But obviously, if someone like Atle Groen dedicates so much time to a book about you and we are ready to publish it, then there is a feeling that people are interested in this story and that it's a story worth telling.
It is kind of a story. Most people have a story, sort of, but mine is a little bit special, I guess, since I've had these two sports.
Yeah.
I guess that's what made it special.
Yeah. Well, let's start at the start of your first big story, the chess story. It has often been said that that it's some sort of a miracle that Magnus Carlsen, that he became world champion, and he was coming from this chessic backwater, Norway, where there was no real chess culture. But then, if we think that, let's say, you started there 20 years earlier, and you played in the junior world championships, you rose to the world top. I mean, there were successes like you were second behind Salov at the European Junior Championship. You played in the same junior world championships as Anand and Ivanchuk, and you finished sixth. How special was it at the time that you achieved that? What was Norwegian chess life like?
When I kind of appeared on the scene, that was very special. I was the first grandmaster in Norway, so it wasn't kind of an environment for top level chess in Norway, but it was perfect for me at the time. I could start. I had a very nice club, Oslo Chess Club, and a good environment, nice people. It was especially one guy, Arnold Eikrem.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be a little bit old to know him, but he kind of run everything in Norway, all tournaments in Norway almost. He had kind of six international tournaments per year.
And these were all the tournaments in Gausdal, where many foreign players, they love to go there to play chess and ski.
And it was a wonderful place. And if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't probably haven't been on the scene either. So you kind of always stand on someone's shoulders. So I have people, I'm kind of a product of an environment. And I think also Magnus is a product of a good environment in Norway. He participated in everything he could in Norway. There were tournaments at his level all the way. Mm. And when he became a grandmaster already when he was 13, it's kind of the world was his playground already. So it wasn't a disadvantage coming from Norway, I think. It still isn't. You see Wesley So coming from the Philippines and so on. I don't think that's a problem any longer. It was perhaps so back in the old Cold War era when all the good players came from the Soviet Union.
Yeah, you mean
that... It's not like that any longer.
No, but it was very special when you were a junior player, and then you mean that you need that kind of luck, that there is someone like Arnold Eikrem, that you find a chess club and that the events are being organized. You have to be lucky there.
There were people around me. There weren't grandmasters, but I had an environment. But if there had been more people, or I could have needed some professional assistance. I didn't kind of have a trainer. First time I had a trainer was after I became a grandmaster, I think, when I was 18. So maybe I could have become better with a more kind of professional program or something. Because my talent was good, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a little bit random. Everything that happened was kind of random. But at the time, I was kind of breaking barriers in Norway, and it was a little, I was a bit lonely because I had to go on my own to tournaments and so on. That was maybe the most difficult part, actually, the loneliness.
That is what we read in the book, in let's say the diary entries that you wrote that are very revealing.
Yes.
Did you recognize all of them when you were reading back these impressions from
you? I was a little bit surprised when Atle found these old diary clips. I can't really remember them, I must admit. I don't even remember I wrote them. But I guess I wrote them in a kind of a self-healing process again, mm-hmm. just as I wrote this thing recently.
But when you read them again,
I liked writing.
When you read them again, could you reimagine how the situation was at the time? And did you see yourself sitting in those rooms again?
Yeah, a little bit. But I made a decision at some moment that this was not a life I would like to live. Mm. It was too lonesome, simply.
Yeah.
Too lonely. And those clips confirm that. And I don't regret. I kind of left the chess quite early, and that's okay. I don't feel I've missed anything, although I could still have perhaps been around for some years.
So when did you take that decision that you didn't want to pursue a professional career anymore?
Yeah, I kind of made a decision when I was about 22 or something, that this was simply, or 21, this was too lonesome. Mm-hmm. Then I kind of simply, okay, I can play soccer, and I can start it at university. I wanted to have a normal life, a social life. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, I don't regret that decision. I regret many other decisions, but not that one.
Mm-hmm. Because while you had been discovered in the chess world, you were invited to very strong tournaments. You were playing against the world elite, Kasparov. He called you the world's strongest amateur. Did you see that as a compliment, or how did you perceive that?
Yes, and to me it's like doping. Everyone else are having trainers and training on a professional level. I was just coming there. So that, I took that as a compliment. So then it was true too.
But it was not, was it also an incentive to work harder? Because
my mind didn't really work like that. I probably would have become better if I worked harder. But I was just playing chess for fun, to put it simple.
Yeah.
And I had an idea that I could become the best in the world. It was nothing wrong with my confidence.
Yeah.
If it's true or not doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. If you believe it, maybe you only become the second best or the third best. But if you don't believe it, then you will maybe end up like I did, like six. I was number 16 at my peak. But it's good to have the confidence, even though it's not realistic. But that was not kind of enough motivation for me.
I mean, you realized that you could get more out of it by working harder, but you simply didn't want to do that.
Yeah, I didn't have the self-discipline, first of all. And just sitting there on my own was horribly boring. I finished upper secondary school. And then I was 1 year in the military. And there I got the chance to play chess kind of more or less full-time. And then that was the time when I improved the most, or when I was at my best, perhaps.
Yeah.
And then the year after, I thought my plan was simply to play chess. And I lasted maybe almost a year. Then I kind of had enough.
Which year was that?
That must have been 88.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I played a tournament in Haninge in Sweden in 88. I did okay. I think Korsner was there, Polgievski. I think I beat Polgievski in a quite nice game.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with the chess. But then the kind of, I got kind of quit playing soccer. I just trained a little bit for fun.
Mm.
But then it was in March or something, and then I was kind of, well, the grass got green. And my coach, Egil Olsen, by the way, who a few years later became the national coach of Norway.
Yeah.
And with a tremendous success, even we beat Brazil. Norway beat Brazil in the World Championship with him as a coach.
He was the famous Drillo.
Drillo, right. He was my club coach, trainer.
Yeah.
And he said, you can just come. You don't. It doesn't matter if you haven't trained for the last 5 months.
Yeah.
So then I just, okay, why not?
Hmm.
So then I started playing soccer again. And just before, in Norway, the season started in kind of late April or something because of the long winter we have here. And then somehow I had a fantastic season. I was very happy. I started starting studying at university. Started studying my worst subject, English. I studied English literature.
Mm-hmm.
It was really my worst subject. My English wasn't very good. It was worse then, to put it that way. But it was my worst subject.
Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to fill holes in my personality because I didn't have an ambition to become anything. I continued studying sociology afterwards. It was 1 year of English and then another year of sociology. But I didn't do very well there. But I was so happy. It was a social environment. I met friends, met girls, and so on. And in that happiness, it was very good for my football too. And then suddenly I came on a national team the same season that I kind of hadn't. I hadn't trained the whole winter, and still I came on the national team. Was selected for a national team in the fall. And then it was kind of no way back because then I got a contract and everything, publicity, and it was still very difficult. Then I kind of tried to focus on soccer, but that was a little bit difficult too because I had the pressure from the chess environment and I had gotten a state scholarship for playing chess, and I suddenly was on the national soccer team instead.
But these.
I was kind of.
How much was that? How big was that support? That.
It was 80,000 crowns. This is about a little bit more than 6,000 euro per year.
So not a.
It wasn't very much.
Yeah.
But it was enough for many people to think that I should play just full time.
Yeah.
But, so I was under pressure. So I just played a little bit here and there. I played some Nordic championships a little bit just. And therefore, kind of, I also played these super tournaments in Tilburg and Belfast and Belgrade and so on.
But even because also, let's say this Nordic zonal was pretty impressive. I mean, you finished ahead of the Icelanders, ahead of Larsen. I mean, that was not just something, that was very impressive.
I kept the level despite almost not training at chess at all.
Yeah.
But maybe started losing the first round or something just to warm up, and then I got going.
Yeah.
But I managed to keep the level. But my focus then was actually on soccer, I must say.
So this is 89, 90... 88.
Yeah, I felt the pressure. 89. I came on the national team in 88, in the spring, fall 88, and I should of course have continued when I was on that team. I didn't understand what a unique chance I had.
Mm-hmm.
So in fall 89, I was invited to Belgrade and Tilburg too. And actually. I had an offer to go to Besiktas, the Turkish club.
Yeah.
But I felt I had accepted to play in Tilburg. I have to, it's a deal. I have to play there simply because it was, I'd accepted it. But,
well, and it was,
that was partly why I refused to play in.
It was the world's leading tournament. And then later you play Belgrade, which was also a super tournament. So
it was a super tournament. I accepted, but that was kind of, I regret that a little bit because after that, the national coach said, okay, you're giving priority to chess instead.
Yeah.
And then I didn't get another chance on the national football team. Basically because of the Belgrade tournament. I had to play. I was selected to play against Scotland. I tried to get the first two rounds a little bit, to play them a little bit later, to get the time to play against Scotland, and to delay the first two rounds.
Yeah.
But the organizers said I couldn't do that.
No.
But such things I really regret now, because of course I should have used the opportunity when I was in the national team.
Yeah, you should not have declined that invitation to play on the national team. That's what you regret.
Yes, yeah. Things like that. And I had offers from all the clubs in Norway, Rosenborg, the best club in Norway, international offers and so on.
You went to train in Scotland and in, what was it, Dundee?
I trained a little bit in Scotland, in Aberdeen.
Aberdeen, yeah.
Yeah, I was on a week's trial there. But it wasn't simple. I was on a week's trial there. That was also a horribly lonesome thing. I was just placed in a hotel room and I wasn't comfortable at all, which of course affects your performance.
Well, that was...
I don't think I impressed anyone in Aberdeen, to put it that way.
Yeah, but that's what struck me, that when you were in Aberdeen, then you also wrote in your diary that, okay, I'm sitting here in this hotel room. And it was just the same solitude that you felt as a chess player. I mean, they're talking about football all the day. They don't speak about anything else. I was thinking that, let's say, anyone who practices a sport is dreaming of this. Well, there's some dream somewhere. And then you're living two dreams. You're playing against Kasparov. You're playing with the national team against Italy. I mean, weren't you enjoying it immensely?
Now, in hindsight, I thought this sounds absolutely fantastic. I should have enjoyed it a lot more.
Yeah.
But now I realize that... Or even in the national team, you kind of build a team. So if you're in the team, you will kind of continue being there despite playing some bad matches and so on, because you're kind of building a team.
Yeah.
And I should, of course, have grabbed the opportunity to be part of that. So and soon after I got injured, when my club coach became the national coach of Norway, and that was good for me. It was my patron, kind of.
Yeah,
then I got injured. And
that was Drillo Olsen. He became the coach of the national team.
Yes. So, and then Norway had two fantastic world championships. We qualified. That's not normal for Norway at all. And we even beat Brazil. And I played with everyone all in that team that beat Brazil.
Yeah.
Same players. That was my generation. So... sometimes I have some bitter thoughts about missing that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I miss most is actually the simple thing of playing and having fun without any stress.
Yeah.
I simply missed playing football for years. I mean, I was sweating in my hands for at least 6 years after I had to quit.
Yeah, because of the knee injury. I mean, it was not that you...
Yeah.
Quit out of free will. I mean, you had to.
Definitely not. It was a knee injury, and it took my whole body to kind of, I wasn't able to concentrate. I was hyperventilating, and my aches were hurt. My arms were aching and everything. So it was my whole body.
And that lasted
for years. Years.
But
I could barely walk.
Yeah. But let's briefly go back to some better memories, Simon. When you had these great years in chess and football, how did playing or sitting opposite Kasparov compare to playing Baresi, Maldini when you're playing Italy?
Playing as Kasparov was of course very special. I felt like I was meeting God, and I thought I had to play like a god, which made me play horrible actually instead. I should just have kept my normal confidence, I think, and have thought that what I normally do should be enough. It wouldn't, but that's what I should have thought.
Yeah.
So I lost three times against Kasparov, so that was kind of no fun. But I struggled with those old guys. I struggled with Timman and Korchnoi. And later on, I met younger guys who were much better, Karan and so on.
Yeah.
But that was kind of different, because I had no respect for these guys. They were just youngsters, and I've seen them as youngsters. But so you found that much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just discovered many years later when I played for these younger guys, I had much less respect because so I struggled a little. I had some kind of mental issues with I should, but I think I would have got used to it with a little bit. I wasn't around for very long. It was just a few tournaments that I played with the very best.
Yeah.
So with a little bit more experience, I think I could have lasted for a while there.
So how did that happen? I mean, you didn't have that that feeling when you were playing Kasparov, but when you were, what was it, 16, when you played Spassky? Then you had all this youthful arrogance of, well, why would he win? We're playing with the same number of pieces. And
Exactly.
And how did that disappear then? Was it because you admired him? Yeah.
I think my natural way of thinking was very good when I played Spassky when I was 16.
Yeah.
And that I think that was very difficult to think in a similar way when I played soccer, actually, because then you have this stupid, or may easily have a stupid trainer saying stupid things to you.
Mm-hmm.
That happened. I had good trainers and horrible trainers. And I kind of I had some trainers really broke me down, and I don't know if they were trying to break me down or what, but it felt like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly was affected by my environment.
What were things that undermined your confidence? What kind of things could people ask you to do or say?
Well, there were, for instance, when we had drilled as a coach, everything was so fun. We used to meet up 15 minutes before the training started just to get started because everything was so fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he left, we had another trainer. If he weren't there 10 minutes, if he weren't shifted and ready 10 minutes before the training started, then you wouldn't were not allowed to join the training.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to me once, and they had to set an example to take me.
Yeah.
It was so many things. Mm. It was absolutely horrible. It felt like having a psychopath as a coach.
And in fact, for your personality, this was totally counterproductive.
Yeah, so I've had coaches like that. So that in that way, chess is much simpler because then you're all on your own. You mm-hmm. don't have anyone disturbing you. But at the same time, you need some competent people around you to say good things because sometimes that is needed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always have everything within yourself. So that's what I'm kind of trying to be to my students now,
mm-hmm.
a competent adult, simple, yeah. As simple as that.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Play on an elegant online chessboard on your favorite chess platforms against old or new friends and without using any screens. You can connect with the DGT app or others, such as the chess.com app. After connecting with an opponent, you can put your phone away and concentrate fully on the board. You will see your opponent's moves through LED rings on the board. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
I still want to know how it felt to play against Baresi.
Yes, exactly.
Was he the one who had to guard you?
Yeah, he was very small. I think he was a head higher than him.
Uh-huh.
So maybe he was 170 or something, I don't know. Defender, world champion a few years before, Gianluca Vialli was there. I noticed he was on the other side of the field. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
Maldini was there. I remember him. It was nothing special. It wasn't very fearful or anything. I think they were more afraid of their legs.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't tackling hard or anything like that.
But Baresi, he was this gentleman defender. Was he a gentleman or...?
Not really. I barely touched him, and then he fell. And then I got, and the referee got told me to calm down. I was barely touched him.
Yeah.
So he was experienced.
Yeah.
I felt it was harder to play a fourth division cup match in Norway.
Oh, really?
With a very, very eager guy who wanted to play again to tackle me.
Yeah.
Who was in the national team. That was much harder.
Yeah.
So it wasn't very fearful, But I had some good matches. I played against Czechoslovakia. My peak in football was very, very good. Yeah. I mean, really good. But that's why I played against Scotland. And after that, I got offered a trial to Aberdeen and so on. Yeah. So some matches I played absolutely fantastic, I would say. But other times I was more anonymous and disturbed by pressure, different things.
Yeah.
So I wish I could have continued playing soccer with more routine, mm-hmm. because I got very disturbed by all the pressure.
Yeah.
Newspapers, professional, someone whispering to me just before a match that Queen's Park Rangers is here watching you.
Yeah.
That destroyed my match totally. I played horrible that match. Uh-huh. I was only thinking about that.
Yeah.
So people around me could easily, I was easily confused by people around me.
Mm-hmm.
And often the people around me weren't very competent.
Well, this is the image that is often portrayed, that you were very insecure and well, sometimes a bit clumsy, that you were not, I mean, there was a lot of doubt in you, that was what people thought. And they, I mean, there's these moments that you were on television and that people thought it was funny because you weren't, well, very certain of yourself.
Absolutely. I was young.
Yeah.
I wasn't very mature for my age, and I was stuttering. I was on television. I wasn't able to say what I wanted to. So I quit that when I was 15, but it appeared reappeared kind of a little mm-hmm. bit later.
You felt very uncomfortable in those situations, or?
So, not as a chess player. Then there I was kind of king in my mm-hmm. environment.
Yeah.
And with soccer, it was a very nice, the national team, the people there were extremely nice. It's the reason they're on the national team.
Yeah.
So they were kind of building me up there too. And the club at that time was also building me up, a good coach.
Mm.
And then I got the national team. Then it was all the pressure from newspapers, professional agents,
mm-hmm.
horrible coaches, that such things disturbed me enormously.
Yeah.
And we were in the second highest division when I got to the national team. Then we got up on the highest one. And then the club bought, I think we bought 11 new players, which changed the club totally. Then it became a professional club.
Yeah.
It was completely different. So I was so happy, and my football playing was much better before I came on the national team than after, actually,
uh-huh.
because of all the pressure.
Yeah.
So it's not like playing fun to have played on the national team, but there and then, it was a lot. I felt the pressure. But with more experience, I think I would have managed much better if I could have kind of been around there for longer.
Yeah. What struck me is when we're talking about football is that you very much were interested in the game itself and not as much in the world of football. I mean, there's this classic moment where in halftime you ask your teammates, who are these guys we are playing? I mean, that kind of stuff. And later, I mean, I remember like Magnus, he's also crazy about football, but he's a walking encyclopedia. And you simply barely follow football. I mean, when was the last time you watched a match live or on television?
Exactly. I barely watch football at all, actually. I actually watched a match just recently because my old club got devalued, or they had to go down 8 divisions or something because of economical problems. And now they're suddenly back on the second highest division. So then I watched a match there. But that's true, I don't follow football at all.
Hmm.
I've never been very interested, for one thing. And another thing is that it just gives me bad memories and...
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, is it because of the injury that I mean,
yeah, it's also because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me of things I've missed a lot in my life.
Yeah,
it's not being on the national team that I miss, but just playing soccer and having fun.
Yeah,
is it reminds me of.
Yeah, well, was that actually, let's say, playing soccer was an even better feeling than playing high-level chess?
Yeah, it's much better, much more fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's physical. I think it's some, I don't know what it's called, but it's some chemistry inside the body that stimulates you. So I just love doing sports in general, actually.
Yeah.
Other sports too, running, anything actually.
Running it can be long distance or what?
And not any longer. After injury, I wasn't able to do even that. But before, I could run a day without training. I trained every day, just something.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, for instance, we ran, it was about 25 kilometers to, we were going to a Christmas party at my uncle's place.
Yeah.
It's 25 kilometers. We just ran there.
Yeah.
So that was no problem.
Yeah, this is what I talked about with Atle. This is, this is a story that your father told me in Tilburg and that you resented that he told me, that you tried to break away from your brother close to the home of your uncle.
Yeah, I heard you talked about that and reminded me of that story.
Yeah.
But it was like that. And it was very random.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a program, a training program or anything. I was quite fit. I was the most fit on the national team, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Oxygen, I don't know what it's called in English, but on test, I was kind of the most fit one.
Yeah.
Because I simply was training almost in different ways.
Yeah.
Could just go out in the forest and be there for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Getting lost, trying to get home. That's a good training.
Yeah, yeah. And you still love the outdoors and moving around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all those things got, I miss all those things, but it wasn't kind of possible after the injuries.
Yeah. Well,
you mentioned something. I was kind of a clown, my clumsiness. You mentioned some clumsiness. And that was kind of true. I was kind of a clown in the football environment.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of a king in the chess environment and a clown when I played soccer, when forgetting things and lots of such stories. And I've actually heard Egil Olsen, this Egil Drill Olsen guy.
Yeah.
He's holding presentations and he says that every environment needs a clown.
Mm-hmm.
And then he often mentions me, actually. So... Mm-hmm. Which is a compliment again.
But you weren't a clown on purpose?
Not on purpose. It was just random things that happened. It's a lot of things.
Did you think
they... It wasn't totally unjustified, to put it that way.
No, but did you think them funny when you realized afterwards what you had done? Or?
Yeah. No problems with that at all. Not at all.
Uh-huh.
So...
Can you give an example of what you thought was funny?
Yeah, for instance, when I had my debut against Italy, we normally stay in double rooms, the players. I was placed in a single room for some reason. I don't know why. But I heard something about that we should, after breakfast, that we should go. I thought we should meet the mayor, that we should come with a suit at 12 o'clock or something.
Yeah.
Then was relaxing on my room a couple of hours. I fell asleep perhaps and then said, oh, it's late. So I put on my suit and ran down. And then everyone was waiting for me at the bus in their jogging suits because we were going out for bowling. And I was coming there with my suits and everyone was, of course, there we have him. That's what we read about. And
because
already I had this reputation of being...
But did they call you the chess player or...
No, I think I got respect as a football player.
Mm-hmm.
So I was good at football. So it was the reason I was there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I got very, very much respect from them.
Mm-hmm.
And actually a few of those players, Erik Thorsvedt, for instance, he was keeper for Tottenham.
Yeah.
he was a fairly decent chess player, maybe 1800 or something. So, but some people think I'm smart since I'm a chess player. That's a general thing many people think.
Well, that's what people think about chess players in general, right?
Yeah, that's why I tell my students to keep quiet when they have journalists here, not to disrupt the impression, not to say anything.
Yeah, just don't say anything. Yeah. So, well, as Adler also describes in the book, that, I mean, you, and as you said yourself, this crisis lasted for several years. And he felt that when you discovered Magnus and started working with him, that that brought back a direction in your life, that it was an important moment to get you back on the rails. Is that how you see it?
Yes. Well, at that time, I was wondering if I was capable of working at all, because my whole body was aching and so on. Yeah. I managed to take a degree in political science, the highest degree you can get, actually, or not the highest, but below PhD, 7-year education at university. So I managed to fulfill that, but I wasn't sure I would be able to work in a normal job, actually. So then this chance to start the chess department at this school appeared. That was, it wasn't a proper job. I barely got paid for it, to put it that way. So the next 10 years, I was kind of wondering, what am I doing? What am I doing here? Everyone else is building careers, having jobs, proper jobs, and some become diplomats and so on.
Yeah.
So, but there was always some talent. I just have to keep it going for a little longer, because and then Magnus came just after a couple of years after I started the school. He came in 2000 approximately. And then I had to continue until he grows up. And so that took another 10 years. And then there were other people coming after him too. So, but now I'm kind of been there almost 30 years. And now I'm happy with that decision.
Yeah.
And I haven't had a proper job my whole life almost, except being a history teacher, as you mentioned, and other subjects too.
Yeah.
But,
The remarkable thing was that you believed in his potential right from the start.
Yeah, it was. I think it's important to believe it. I believe it fully. There's no doubt about that. But if you don't, then certainly it won't happen.
Yeah.
So it helps believing it. And for him, with him, it was quite obvious. The talent was so obvious. So it wasn't a hard prediction.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that was a fantastic adventure following his successes. We followed him from he was 9 till he was, number 5 or 6 in the world when he quit at my school.
Yeah.
And a half a year later, he was number 1. So that was a fantastic adventure to follow that so closely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and in his slipstream, other talents were coming, and other young grandmasters were.
Yes, altogether we have I think we have approximately 11 grandmasters that have come out of this.
Yeah.
And we got the Arjan Tari, who became world junior champion when he was at my school.
Yeah.
And these days we have Ilham Ammar, who I've written about in your magazine, actually.
Yeah, I want to speak about him later. Maybe we should briefly pause with Magnus. As Adler writes, he says, well, Simon and Magnus, that's the Norwegian school of chess. I mean, it's the fight is decided at the board. I mean, you should prepare, of course, but the real fight is at the board, and you're looking for new adventures all the time. That sounds attractive. I mean, is this what was both the strength of you and Magnus?
Magnus is, of course, a lot better version than I am.
Yeah.
But Magnus is kind of my favorite player. He's really the ideal, what I would, if I should design a chess player, it would be like him.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to play everything. He's able to play sharp openings. He knows everything in theory. just being best at everything. It's as simple as that. He is best at everything.
I mean, all the aspects of the game.
All the aspects of the game, all openings, no limits. Blitz, rapid, classical. So when I hear Magnus talk and play, I see many of the things that it was kind of my dream chess player.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy with that, and I don't know how much my influence has been on him on these things, but he's definitely the person that is most. He's a fast learner, to put it that way. Extremely fast.
Yeah,
you could barely mention a thing. You don't even have to. You can almost whisper it, and it would take it right away. So a fantastic person to work with, of course.
Yeah, this absorbing knowledge. I remember when he went for his second Grandmaster Norm in Moscow at the Aeroflot Open in 2004. I gave him one of the new volumes of Kasparov's predecessors. And he was reading it in the evening, and I think he saw some opening idea. I think it was by Geller. And the next day, he just played it and beat the Grandmaster.
Typical. That's very typical.
Yeah.
There's always an idea. Sometimes it seems like Magnus is just playing something random. But to me, it seems like he's extremely well prepared that he has ideas in almost every opening and everything he plays.
Yeah.
And also often there is something like that. That something is just read the day before, or some very local inspiration to put it that way.
But it's funny that you call him your favorite player or your perfect player, because what I thought was some similarity is that the way you are not interested in football stars or whatever, you're not following it. And I see whenever Magnus is asked about his favorite chess players, he says, well, actually, I don't have any favorite chess players. Did you have any examples when you were a young chess player, or were you so individualistic that you had a similar feeling that I don't have heroes? Or
that's true. I didn't have heroes either.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of the Karpov generation. Tried to play calm and smooth and just outplay our opponents. And then came Kasparov. Mm. It wasn't possible to play like Kasparov. So at that time, now it's later on, of course, times have changed. Now everyone is kind of trying to play like Kasparov. But Kasparov had his limits. He played the same openings all the time, for instance.
Yeah.
And Karpov certainly had his limits. I think Magnus is kind of a combination of Kasparov and Karpov.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Kasparov perhaps said too, that it felt like training with Karpov when Magnus started training with Kasparov just after he quit the school here. And I think I read somewhere that it felt like training with Karpov, that Magnus was very Karpov-like.
Mm-hmm.
But Magnus also has the Kasparov ability. He's able to play the sharpest openings and long theoretical lines and so on too.
But there clearly is your influence, as you would tell him that, whenever he played an opening and he had success, they said after a couple of games, you should switch to another opening.
Yeah, because the goal is to learn. Yeah. As much as possible. And when you know an opening, then it's time to play a new one.
Yeah.
You can't play things you already know.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be in opposition to many other players, because they seem to, for instance, learn the Russian or some openings horribly well. And the players stick to that and play that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I see so many players doing just that. And that was not my philosophy, not at all. And it seems not to be Magnus' philosophy either.
Yeah,
but still, it seems like Magnus is able to play theoretical duels with Vachier Lagrave in Nydorf and in the Grünfeld with Peder Swidler and so on.
Yeah, just as further evidence of his completeness. I mean, he can do that as well. Yeah. So, you realized what kind of a special player he was because you had an eye for that. Some years ago, you told me about Elam Amar, and you wrote about him for New in Chess. What is special about him? I mean, it's clear that you see some potential there. I mean, not compared to Magnus, but he is a talent.
Yes, I have talents all the time. And some become grandmasters, some don't improve at all.
Yeah.
This year, for instance, I have 13 students. Last year, I had 16. Next year, it will probably be only 10. And now and then, there comes a GM potential. It's very easy to see if they have the potential to become a grandmaster,
mm-hmm.
or just an IM or nothing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Elam's potential. Now I've learned to know him quite well for a couple of years. His talent is enormous, absolutely. But talent is a lot more than just chess. As I talked a little bit with Ivan Sokolov about that, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sokolov is concerned about or focus on if he's a good hard worker or not. I'm not sure. It's easy to see weaknesses in Elam's play, to put it that way.
Yeah.
But still, he's making GM performances all the time,
mm-hmm.
with so many weaknesses.
And you also wrote that he
says something about his potential.
Yeah, and there's a lot, let's say, missing in his chess education. I mean, there's all
kinds. A lot.
Yeah.
But still, he's winning big tournaments and playing at the GM level without having opened a chess book his whole life.
Yeah, that's amazing. How do you explain that? I mean,
I wonder if Nakamura, how many chess books he has opened, and Buga Gashimo too, I've heard, mm-hmm. barely read chess books. So that seems to be possible these days.
Yeah.
But Magnus was reading chess books all the time.
Yeah.
I think he's read everything. It feels like he's read everything.
But Elam does work with the computer, or?
He works with the computer, that's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a little bit demanding to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a pure chess talent.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with him only for a couple of years. If we started working with him, if he had got the same following up as Magnus had got from when he was 9,
yeah.
Maybe he would also become at the same level even.
Yeah.
So you can say the same thing with many others too. Not they wouldn't become Magnus, but they would become could have become very well good players or much better if we started working with them from their very young. But we don't have that tradition in Norway.
Yeah.
You're more left to yourself until they kind of come to me when they're 16 or 15. I follow up a few guys, younger talents too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to see GM potential in many.
Yeah.
But if there is more than that, that's then the challenging parts come.
Well, I already mentioned it. One of the amazing things is that last year and the year before that, you won the Norwegian championship. What does that say? Does it say something about the love for the game that you still have, or that you maybe you rediscovered? Or is it still this, being attracted to challenges? Okay, I'm going there and let them beat me.
Yes, very often I just appear just to let them, because this is where the list is. They have to beat me to become GMs.
Yeah.
As I very often think like that. But I think I still have the potential. But it's a little bit random, because sometimes I feel tired. This is physical challenges that one have.
Yeah.
When you're 50s, in the mid-50s. Mm. So I feel those challenges, but sometimes I feel okay. And then my chess is almost as it was before too.
Mm-hmm.
I played in Norway Chess, for instance, 10 years ago or almost.
Yeah.
I think it's 10 years ago, actually. I did.
2014,
started with 7 draws. Should have won a few games there.
Yeah, you had two wins or something, yeah?
I was clearly winning in a couple of games. Yeah. I was very annoyed I didn't win the tournament.
Yeah, yeah.
And it annoyed me even more because I wouldn't get that chance again.
Mm.
20 years after the last time I played a real super tournament. But in the next tournament, I'm very up and down, or because physical, I don't prepare so much and so on. Mm-hmm. But when I try to take it seriously, I think I can still be playing okay. But definitely mental tiredness is an issue at my age.
Yeah. But do you still love the struggle like you loved it?
I think it's demanding because you have to create something. I feel I have to create something in every game.
Yeah.
And that means you have to prepare. You have to have some idea in the opening and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's demanding. That's the most demanding part, I think.
Yeah,
Simply playing is okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I have my big limitations. If I play E4, I'm a completely different player in many openings that I don't know well and so on.
Yeah.
So before I was just interested in learning new openings. It doesn't work like that any longer.
Yeah.
Now I'm just hanging on with my older
repertoire,
which I'm very, very tired of.
Yeah.
So... But I look at chess almost every day, so with my students.
Yeah.
So I guess that helps a bit.
Yeah. Well, you said something about the therapeutic significance of the book, of having closed the period and, well, dealt with some problems that you had before. So the horizon is clear. Do you have any specific big plans or some dreams that you're working on or... projects?
Yes, absolutely. But I'm very lucky because this school, I'm so happy with this school. So now I'm I'm 57 years old. So I see new talents. That's my main inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also fun with those not that enormously talented chess players, but brilliant or interesting person. I like being with the youngsters, to put it simple.
Mm-hmm.
I just enjoy being with the youngsters.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that. So no personal goals or anything.
No, no.
Well, except for try my best to develop the youngsters.
Yeah. Well, and let's say many of the side attractions, if we call them, they mostly find you. You don't have to go looking for them, like when you were on Dancing with the Stars and things like that.
Yes.
So, I think that there must be many surprises still waiting for you.
Yeah, there are some surprises, and that's color in life.
Yeah.
But I'm very lucky and happy with the life I've had and the life I have at the moment.
Sounds great, Simon. Well, I'm very grateful that you took your time to join us, and thank you for your stories, which are a beautiful supplement to the book, which is a beautiful book. So I wish you all the luck in everything you're doing.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If you're interested in Atle Groen's new book, Games and Goals, on the spectacular chess and football careers of Simon Agdestein, please visit our website, newinchess.com. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.